Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. If you're watching this interview, I'd always appreciate a comment, or if you're listening to it, you know, a review would be nice as well. Today, my guest is Dr. Adriana Bankston. While she has a PhD in biochemistry, cell and developmental biology, her career does not involve being in a lab. In fact, she works on science policy. So I'm really interested to find out more about how she came to her line of work and how her PhD informs it. Welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Dr. Bankston.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
So from the bit of research I did on you, I saw you got your first degree in biological sciences. So where did the interest in biological sciences come from?
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to mention here, I actually grew up in a family of scientists. My parents are both faculty, so I've always been around the academic world. Was somewhat likely that I would end up doing something with biology or biochemistry. Actually, I have my parents and then also another generation. Actually, my grandmother still does research. So multiple generations of research in science and healthcare. I've been around that and grew up going to the lab with my parents and all of that. So I was very likely I would end up doing something with science. And then we moved to the South a few years ago after high school. So I did most of my education there. And then had a good time, enjoyed that. But as you mentioned, ended up going a different route. So I'm happy to talk more about that.
Oh, sure. So it sounds like your parents and even your grandmother was involved in sciences. So are you saying that if you'd went to your parents at one point and said, I want to be a dancer, would that have been a problem?
Yeah, likely not. They would support it. It's somewhat like that now with science policy, because they want me to be happy and enjoy what I'm doing, but you know, they don't really know what it means to do it on a daily basis. So that's, I always have to explain what it means.
Well, I also saw, I mentioned in the intro that you did a PhD as well. So what was the motivation to get a PhD?
Somewhat similar. I for a long time, I thought I would end up in academia and was going that route. I really like the research environment and thinking through problems, working with great colleagues. I had a great PI at Emory. She was actually one of the two female PIs in the department, which is interesting too, because I think a lot about the makeup of the future of science and who do we see in these roles as role models. But I was very interested in academia for a long time and thought I would end up there, but did not, obviously.
I'm actually kind of curious about that. So what made you change your mind as to, I guess, why did you decide not to go into academia?
So really started during my postdoc. So I ended up going to University of Louisville, and this sort of, you know, middle of nowhere, I was trying to figure out my next steps. And I became interested in how universities can support the next generation of scientists, for the most part, because I was trying to figure out my path out of the lab. You know, how could I use my scientific background to help society? And so I have sort of dual interests. One is really, and I've worked on this for a few years, thinking through how the research system needs to change and the reforms that we need. And so, you know, I published, ran programs, did some advocacy for that sort of from the research side with a nonprofit. And so that's a really strong area that I sort of developed through my own transition, thinking, how can I leave the lab? How can I use my science more broadly? And that led to becoming interested in policy in the sense of what institutions can be doing and what university policies we need to support researchers who want to stay in science. And that means, you know, they need better, you know, support for mental health or better pay, a lot of things, right? And the other side is, and now I'm sort of on the side of a lot of students that reach out to me who are interested in policy careers. And so now I've sort of shifted towards how do we help a graduate student in STEM transition into a policy career? But it's still very related to the academic space. And so that's one thing. I'll say that I think having been in academia and knowing what it's like to be a student and a postdoc and the successes that you have and those struggles that you have can really help inform the policies you develop because you've been there in their shoes and you know what that's like. So that's kind of how it started.
Okay. So when you were doing your postdoc is when you decided this whole idea of getting into policy was something you wanted to pursue. How did you actually go about doing it?
Yeah, so I got involved with a nonprofit. It's called Future of Research. You may have heard of it. So basically, they were doing research on research. We wanted to, and this was a few years ago when these discussions were still just starting to happen because academia is not transparent in a lot of ways. So they were trying to leverage sort of their, independent nonprofit position to be able to push universities to do different things to support their students. And so we did research, essentially, surveys from students and postdocs to ask about what they think about the system, what they needed. We ended up writing some papers about mentoring and career development, of course, the things that you would think about that these are the things they need and isn't always obvious where to find it, or if they have issues with their advisor they wouldn't bring that up, but this was a general sense of here's what students are saying across the country, and we published that and that again use that to try to improve the system from the outside. That was really a large portion of this because I left my postdoc, was working with this nonprofit, and then that really highlighted the opportunity to maybe try to make an impact in policy for postdocs. And where could I do that sort of at the federal level, right? And so I moved around, lived in California for a few years, was working for them there, and then ended up going to a few of the campuses from the UC system actually to do advocacy training because a lot of students are like, well, we want to use our research more broadly. How do we do that? Because no one's trained us. So I'm sort of was able to use my interest in training and, again, career development, but also trying to, and I was starting to develop this interest in federal policy through these experiences. But again, I wasn't in it yet until I actually moved to DC and started to, do activities here. And I can talk about that too. So it's been an interesting journey.
What would the landscape look like ideally if these research institutions instituted, the initiatives or, the initiatives that you would think would be beneficial to the students or just to the, the society generally?
Yeah, I think it should be more accepting of certain ideas and cultures. Diversity is still a major issue in a lot of levels, especially as you move up to the faculty. There's still fewer faculty who are women. I think also being able to have these conversations, like mental health is a big issue that, students don't feel comfortable talking to their advisors about it. I think just being more accepting that, scientists are human and all these things they're going through and the things that they need from the university should be there. And we, most of our work was related to postdoc pay. And so we advocated for that and actually got some universities to increase the pay, which is really important because it will also, prohibit certain people from staying in science if they can't live on the salary. And that's not always possible depending on where you live. So that's what I would say. I think just realizing that scientists, while they're producing grants and papers, they're human beings who have these needs that are very basic at the end of the day, that but also just being more accepting that you're there and you're there to learn and to thrive and to be able to bring up these issues if you have them. Just more transparency, more acceptance of the issues that scientists go through. They're not just you know, there to produce data.
What pushback have you gotten from the institutions based on the initiatives that you want to see implemented?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, it's not always possible to do this. I think we try to use it to sort of think through maybe related to peer pressure. You know, if you had two universities that were close together in one state and one was paying the postdocs more, and of course, like, okay, postdocs are going to go to the school instead of the other one. They don't always have the funds. And, sometimes it's mandated federally, right? So then you have to go to the agencies and say, can you increase the salaries from the NIH, for example, because institutions can only do so much based on how much they're given, you know, what the federal law says and all of that. So for the most part, it's nothing negative, really. It's just been a few schools are more receptive to this, or maybe had more money and were able to do it. And then others didn't really respond, but I think it did create a, you know, awareness that postdoc pay was low and this was a national issue. And we saw results of that based on our research.
I was reading an article recently about postdocs, and it was saying that if you're a postdoc who was hired essentially by the university, as opposed to having your own funding and being a postdoc within someone's lab, and there's differences sometimes even in what you're called. So if you're hired by the university, you could be called a postdoctoral fellow, but if you're bringing your own funding, you might be called a postdoc scholar. They're just different terms. And they also said that even your rights within the university may be different, whether, you know, depending on where your funding comes from. Is this something that you work on as well?
Yeah, so we actually published a paper as a follow-up after the initial paper with the salaries that we requested salary data from institutions. I think we had about 50 schools. And it's interesting because it's still somewhat nebulous, but based on what we found and the data that we were given, I think there were 11 postdoc titles, and there were things like, you know, associate, researcher. Then it was like the medical ones were different, had different titles. And also the pay really varied. I mean, it was probably about 50,000 on average per year. But, it does make a difference if you're called the postdoctoral associate or researcher or something. Again, if you're in the medical field, that's a little higher. Or if you work in a medical school, that also makes a difference. So I can share the paper because it's fascinating just how it is. And I think another problem is the cost of living, right? Because that's not really taken into account because there is a national average and there's limitations to how much they can give. But it's nice to see that there's more discussions on this now from the agencies too, because it is a large issue across the board.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting when I was reading this article, because they were saying that based on where your funding is from, you may not even be eligible for health insurance from the university or even to use the school's gym. It was just like, damn, like basically you're being penalized for bringing in your own funding.
Yeah, that's another issue, I think. And I, you know, would have to do more research into this, but I know some fellowships have limitations and the things you can apply to and what kind of benefits you have, where some of them don't have any. Then you have to figure that out and get it from other places, even if you have your own grant. That's a big area too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the work that you currently do now, what does it entail?
Yeah. So right now I'm a senior fellow in civic science and public policy with Sigma Xi, which is a research society. We're actually trying to expand, and it's interesting because there's been a lot of discussions about expanding science policy opportunities across the country, and a lot of state level fellowships and programs being developed. It's a growing area now. What we're doing is developing a digital platform essentially to connect different state policy players together. Like I said, there's policy fellowships and universities that develop programs, kind of a one, you know, one-stop shop where students can go and trainees and folks at different career stages who are just in policy can go and find out about opportunities they can apply to, and then be find mentors and folks who they can talk to, sort of a matching process to where you can put in your interests and you get a number of opportunities, and then match with people that are in those fields. It's a large endeavor. We're hoping to make it also useful in terms of maybe having some trainings in person, because there's some limitations to having a digital tool, but I think it'll help to bring the community together where there's sort of folks are sort of all over the place. And again, for trainees and students to be able to find these things in one place, I think it'll be helpful.
If you're someone coming out of school and like yourself want to get involved in policy work, what do you think those type of people should do?
So I would recommend, if you can get involved locally with your university. So nowadays there's a lot more opportunities and, science policy groups, a lot of the universities, if you can get involved to organize a workshop or a training, that's a good skill, because having worked in policy, I realized that there's a lot of event planning and being able to bring people together and convenings and discussions. And so being able to do that locally is helpful. Writing is another big thing. And of course, what we're doing here, these kinds of conversations, being able to talk about your science to a non-scientist, writing blog posts and anything that's not an academic paper, will really get your brain going and thinking more broadly about research topics that can be helpful. I would recommend also getting involved with nonprofits or organizations that help, that are in different types of policy areas. My path sort of has been around academic, higher ed, and research policy. I've sort of built my career on that, and that's worked well. So if you have an area that you're interested in, you can kind of build your brand around that. And of course, these science policy fellowships, which are again state level ones, are popping up. More of them are developed. A lot of them are in DC, and I'm happy to also talk more about that, or folks who want to connect. I can provide some resources as to where those are, because that was helpful for my transition too. So if you're, I think there's different levels. If you're in academia, you want to kind of dabble into policy and see what it's like, there's opportunities for that. If you want to fully transition, there's fellowships and things you can do to prepare for that and transition to a policy role.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned the importance of being a scientist and speaking to non-scientific audiences. Is that something you've always been good at? And if not, what did you do to get better at it?
No, definitely not. I, was a typical scientist. You're used to talking to your peers about topics that you know of. I think I sort of forced myself to get out of my comfort zone, whether it was, self-directed or the situation required it. I tend to be pretty introverted generally, but if I have something that I'm really passionate about, I'll, come out of my shell and talk about postdoc issues like I'm doing now. I'm not, this is a stretch. I have to, get used to it. I think it's interesting because in my career, I've had a lot of different audiences and trying to push different things, right? So talking to scientists, talking to university administrators, policymakers, folks on the Hill and agencies to try and change some of these things. So some of it is just having something that I'm really excited about, then I'll kind of start talking and it'll come out. I will say that I do a lot of preparation beforehand, as you should prepare for all kinds of meetings that you have, because sometimes in policy things come up quickly and you have to run a meeting within the 24 hours or so, and you didn't know you had to do that sometimes in 2 hours. But that used to happen, in my previous job, which is just how it goes, because things change so quickly, so you have to be able to adapt. Maybe a new bill that came out, or there's a new meeting you have to run, for whatever reason in 2 hours. So you kind of get used to being just learning on the job in a sense. But I always try to prepare and take notes and at least have something that I know I'm going to say in broad terms that helps to when going into it.
So when it comes to the presentations that you give, do you have a process for putting them together? And if so, what is it?
So you mean PowerPoints or just any kind of discussions?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think trying to think about what my goal is for the presentation and kind of matching that with the audience, right? So a lot of the work that I've done has been with policymakers and what they're interested in. So you have to know what kind of policies they're interested in at the time, what kind of bills they're working on, who's the right legislator or staffer to approach. Really researching your audience, I think, is really important. And having a goal of what you want to get out of the meeting, because sometimes you have 15, 20 minutes, you know, Hill staffers, for example, may not give you 30 minutes. So you have to just be very quick in and out. Here's what I need. Here's why I think you care. Here's how much money I'm asking for, and having specific numbers. That's one of the things that I see a lot of times. And, you know, it takes practice for students to get to that point of, you know, what is the ask that you have for a policymaker? They want to know very specifically what that is and quickly. So you kind of get in that feeling for how to do that after a while. If you've been in a few meetings and you kind of see how it is. But I, you know, do try to have a specific ask for them, and then try to match that with what I think their interests are. And again, comes back to doing your research a lot of times, because you need to know their background and where they are on the issue.
Do you ever get nervous before giving a presentation? And if so, how do you deal with your nerves?
Yes, I do. I still do. Drink water, you know, breathing. Sometimes do like quick meditations. You know, I would recommend that if you're really nervous, just like 5 minutes of breathing beforehand, then you get into a good state. But for me, it's more about preparation. I think, you know, researching, like I said, I researched the podcast before coming on here. I listened to a previous guest, you know, wrote down some notes of what I might want to talk about. So I think if you prepare and you know what you're going into, you know, you can kind of go with the flow from there, but that's what I do.
Yeah. The water one's an interesting one. Hopefully you don't drink too much. Next thing you go to the bathroom while you give your presentation.
Yeah.
Hey,
that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. At least you're not going to get bored. It's like, all you're thinking about is, man, I need to pee, but I want this presentation to be over as quickly as possible. And I want the bathroom to be very close.
Yeah. Don't drink too much water. Drink a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the people who are watching or listening to this conversation, Dr. Bankston, and they want to get better at giving presentations, what would your number one tip be?
Yeah, I think I would say just prepare, do your research, read the background and who you're going to talk to, and learn as much as you can beforehand, because that'll help. And also, you know, think about what you want to get from that conversation, because you don't want to go in there and not have really a specific ask. A lot of times that can be an issue, because at least that's one thing I've learned in policy. You know, everyone is always in a rush. You know, there's always too many things to do. And if you have those 15 minutes, you know, make it worth their time and tell them what you want from it.
Yeah, I think that makes perfect sense, just having that specific ask, because as you said, these people don't have a whole lot of time, so they want to make sure that the time that they do have is well spent. And if they're sitting in a presentation and at the end of it, they have no clue why they were in the presentation in the first place, they might be a little upset about that. So it's on you as the presenter to make it known, you're here for this reason. I need this. Give me this. Yeah, that's absolutely an excellent idea. So this has been a great conversation, Dr. Bankston. Thank you so much for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you?
Oh, thanks for having me here. So you can go to my website, adriannabankston.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. All of my contact is on there. Feel free to email me. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter. So any of those social media, I would be great to connect.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Dr. Bankston.
Thank you.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms. We're on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.